come ride.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, all you magnificent melon heads of the world. Happy Thursday, everybody. Today is June 18th, 2026. And our top story this morning is Kevin Warsh, a.k.a. Kurt Hawk. That's my new nickname for our new Fed chairman, Kurt Hawk. He doesn't say a lot, and he was put there to be a dove, but he's not very dove. By the way, I just love that name. I hope that sticks. It sounds like an 80s action star name. Kurt Hawk was a cop and good at his job, but he raised rates and burst the AI bubble, and now he's running for his life. Kevin Warsh is the chair. Look, he came out yesterday, and I joked that, you know, he was going to be more Kurt than Kevin in my monologue yesterday, and then he actually came out and said that he was being Kurt during the press conference yesterday, which had me LOLing just a little bit. But he completely slashed and burned the Fed's previous statements. You know, they used to, like, change one word. You'd get that long statement. There'd be one little crossed-out line where they replaced the word very with slightly, and everybody'd be like, oh, my God, what does this mean? What's the Fed going to do now? He got rid of all that crap, and he threw in at the end of his statement, which was only like a paragraph and a half long, and he throws in at the end, the committee will deliver price stability, and he ends that with a period. That was the ending statement, and the market really latched onto that. And look, everybody was afraid of Fed independence, and rightly so. Trump went after the last chairman, and he tried to put pressure on the Fed to cut rates. And a lot of people thought he installed Kevin Warsh for the sole purpose of cutting rates. Warsh made it abundantly clear yesterday that is not what he intends to do. We'll see if the actions meet those words, but there was no room for interpretation. The committee will deliver price stability. That means we see inflation is becoming a problem again, and that is our priority, which means higher rates, not lower. During the press conference, he came out and he even said, I was blown away by this statement. He said, we've missed, this is in reference to inflation, we've missed for 5 years, and we're going to fix that. All right, we have come a long way, folks. Understand, this is the same position here where Jerome Powell came out and talked about how inflation was transitory and we're going to stick the soft landing and we've largely vanquished inflation, and everybody in the press pool would cheer for him with their pom-poms and congratulate him on a job well done. No, Kevin Warsh came out and said, that's bullshit. We've missed for 5 years. We're going to fix that. And it's true. The Fed has not hit its inflation target and actually closer to 6 years. No mincing words there. He comes out as a hawk. And then I say the term Kurt Hawk because he's not saying much. I mean, he was a poker player yesterday. I was joking around. I put out a couple of pictures like Phil Hellmuth and a hawk playing poker. He gave nothing. The press was pushing him for details. They were pushing him to make forecasts. Oh, if this happened, would you do this or why not do this now? He gave them nothing. He did that on purpose. All right. First of all, he limited reporters to two questions. And if he didn't like their question, he would tell them he didn't like their questions. No forecast. And he was even cornered. He said, hey, one person asked him, the fact that you're not giving any forecasts and you're not doing these forward-looking statements, won't that increase market volatility? And there is some truth to that. Yes, if the market sees well in advance what the Fed is going to do, then when the Fed takes that action, it will be less volatile. But the problem is that also gets rid of price discovery. And Kevin Warsh pointed this out. He says, when economic data gets released, we want the market to look at the economic data and react based on that economic data, not react based on what it thinks the Fed might do based on that economic data. In other words, he wants to return price discovery to financial markets. I found that incredibly refreshing. I don't know if he's going to deliver on that, but at the very least, he's saying it. Let's take that for the win that it is. Yep, it's going to be more volatile. It's supposed to be more volatile. You're not supposed to have this behemoth central bank that comes in and smooths out every bump, ultimately causing the problems to get worse and worse over time. Now, he did make some other statements here that were very open to interpretation when he was asked, is monetary policy restrictive enough? And this was in the context of why didn't you raise rates if you thought, you know, inflation was a problem? And he made this distinction. He did this twice during the press conference. He says, if you look at the housing market, monetary policy looks restrictive enough, right? We've had a frozen housing market for 3 years. Home prices aren't coming down. They're still too high. But at the very least, they stopped going up and transactions are very low. The housing market is pretty much frozen, and that is due to higher interest rates pricing out a lot of buyers. So yeah, if you look at the housing market, monetary policy looks restrictive. But then Warsh twice went on to say, if you look at financial markets, i.e. stocks and derivatives, which are just going cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, he says monetary policy is clearly not restrictive. Now, he didn't make any policy prescription based on that condition. He basically said policy in some areas of the market is restrictive and elsewhere it isn't. So I don't really know what to make of that. And he didn't say what he was going to do. But if he believes housing is already restrictive, then he certainly probably is not going to go sell mortgage-backed securities from the Fed's balance sheet. He's probably going to leave those there. But does that also mean he's going to take some action, i.e. rate hikes or some other type of tightening of policy in order to bring financial asset prices back down to earth? And he was basically suggesting stocks were too high. Either way, that's not the words of a man who intends to pump markets, that's for sure. Now, he did punt a little bit on some key issues. He mentioned that he was starting several task forces. And whenever he got into a question where they were like trying to get him to tip his hand a little bit on policy decisions, he basically said, we have a task force for that. And that was part of his poker face. I will tell you nothing. I will give you nothing. I have appointed a task force. And maybe that's just an out. Maybe that's a way for him to avoid answering difficult questions by saying this task force will handle it. Or, you know, maybe he really intends to make big policy decisions, but he doesn't want to make those in a vacuum. And he wants to at least create the appearance of a deliberate, you know, well-informed and educated process. Now, the one thing I was worried about, one of his task forces was to explore metrics and how they're measuring things like inflation and how they're measuring jobs. Anytime I see something like that, that gave me pause. I was a little worried. Because remember, he was put there to cut rates, and he's not talking like he's going to cut rates. But when he starts talking about messing with the ways we count things or the ways we measure things, that gives me a little bit of worry that he might change the definitions of inflation and then use that to cut rates anyway into high inflation. He didn't give me any reason to think that's what he's going to do. This is just Jack with his paranoid tinfoil hat on saying maybe that's what he's going to do. That was really the only thing he said that I didn't like when he appointed the task force to go look at the way they measure things. And I know why they're doing that, because the Fed is always viewed as reactionary. By the time they change something, the problem has already happened. And when they change things, they just create the next crisis. So I get the reasoning for that. I just don't like to see them changing the instrumentation in the economy. That's all. Now, he also had some interesting things to say about AI. And I'm pretty sure, and this is my interpretation, I'm pretty sure he said AI was a bubble without saying it was a bubble. Now, Warsh has made a lot of statements about how he thinks AI is awesome and he thinks it's going to usher in a new era of productivity, right? All the hype that the Silicon Valley bros have been putting out. He has definitely drank that Kool-Aid. But what he said yesterday in regards to AI, he talked about how you can already see AI's effect on demand. In other words, AI is creating inflation. It's driving up the price of copper. It's driving up the price of fuel, construction equipment, generators. Even Apple, we got a story about Apple raising prices on iPhones because of memory chip prices, right? That's all because of the AI bubble. So he's saying you can already see the effect on demand. AI is causing inflation. Ah, but AI is supposed to be deflationary. AI is supposed to create more productivity, and more productivity is a way to grow an economy without causing inflation. But he went on to say that you can't really measure that productivity or that they can't see it. And well, you're right, you can't see it and it is difficult to measure. But let me just throw this out there. Maybe the reason productivity increases from artificial intelligence are difficult to measure is because there freaking aren't any. Outside of coding, I know there's always some Silicon Valley bro in the comments who's like, oh, I'm a software developer and I use AI all the time. Yes, we get it. Your industry uses AI. Nobody else is really doing anything with it. All right. And Warsh pretty much said that. We can see no effect of on productivity caused by AI. In other words, this is me extrapolating that. All this money is being burned for nothing, driving up the price of things with no commensurate gains in productivity. In other words, the AI bubble is highly inflationary. And if that's the case, how do you fix that? You raise interest rates so that these companies that are now leaning heavily on the debt market can no longer afford to do so, and that capital misallocation goes away. And I think that's what Warsh suggested he was going to do yesterday. A man after my own heart. Now, here's the big question with Kevin Warsh. Can he do nothing? And you can say all the right things at the meetings and at the podiums, and we can all cheer for that. But when the crisis happens, when the AI bubble bursts, or when some bank goes under, or when some asset class that we can't see right now starts to blow up, does the Fed do what the Fed has always done? Do they lower and print? That's my big question for Kevin Warsh. I don't care what he says at the meetings. Can he do nothing? Because that's what we really need the Fed to do, is nothing. The next time the rot dies, let it die. And then maybe this inflation problem will go away. But overall, I will give Kevin Warsh a 95 out of 100 for what he did yesterday. He loses 5 points for that thing about the metrics. But other than that, I was very happy with what I heard yesterday. Meanwhile, we got stocks are up this morning on the Iran deal, which is just an outright terrible deal for the United States. The text of that has been released. Look, guys, there's no beating around the bush. We may have won all the battles, but we clearly lost the war in Iran. The stated goal of the conflict was regime change in Iran. And even though we killed the Ayatollah and his underlings, we definitely did not topple the Iranian regime. They're still there. They're going to come back arguably even more belligerent than they were before, because we fought the war not to win. We fought the war where we were more worried about the price of crude oil than anything else, instead of achieving victory on the battlefield. And that's why we lost. It's the same reason we lose all the other wars we lose, is because we let the politicians fight in political ways instead of letting the military do what they do best. I would not have started this conflict to begin with, but had I been in charge, I sure as hell would have fought it differently. That being said, we've got some Saudi tankers are finally transiting the Strait of Hormuz. 6 million barrels of oil has gotten out in the last 24 hours. That is way more than usual, but it's going to be a while before we get back to normal. We got this article about China and India saying they can't find tankers. We'll talk about why they can't find tankers and why that's important. Also, I think this deal is so bad, it's just setting up for the next fight. 60 days to flatten the curve, if you will. We've got Intel stock is ripping on some comments that President Trump made that may or may not be true. Apple, as I mentioned, is raising prices due to memory shortages. That's the AI bubble causing inflation. We've got Semaphore out with an article about the Trump administration and Trump's advisors arguing over the structure of the U.S. government taking a stake in AI companies. This is interesting, since we're all going to be AI bag holders, paper or plastic. That's the question. On top of that, we've got Indonesia has raised rates for the third time in a month. That is important because Indonesia is the next Venezuela, in my opinion. And there's one reason that this article about the third rate hike only mentions in one sentence, but I think that's what's really driving this. Canadian PPI jumped again, astronomically high, more inflation on the horizon here. And Oaktree's private credit fund, this is pretty interesting. Oaktree's private credit fund redemptions have dropped below 5% and therefore are not halted. And the reason why I mention this is because this is news. This is like big news on Bloomberg. Private credit fund does not gate redemptions. So what stage are we in the bubble where so many people are limiting redemptions that when one actually doesn't limit, it becomes news? That in and of itself is a signal, in my opinion. Guys, we got a lot to talk about this morning. Why don't we shrink my big melon of a head and let's see what's going on in the world of finance. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button for the algorithm so you can come back tomorrow and have your coffee with the melon heads, because we do this every business day. And right now, stocks are in the green. The S&P is up 65 points or 0.88% ahead of the open. The Dow is up by 252 points or about a half a percent in the green as well. And the NASDAQ is ripping this morning, up 502 points, almost 1.7% higher. I'm sure the restoration of the flow of oil through the Strait of Hormuz is front and center in traders' minds this morning. The dollar is quite stronger here, 100.72, higher by 33 basis points after the dollar took quite a jump yesterday. Now, this is interesting. The dollar strengthening, even though oil prices are way down. For the last several months, we've seen the dollar and oil prices kind of moving in tandem with one another. But then yesterday, we got the big down move in oil because of Iran, but we got the big up move in the dollar because of Kurt Hook over at the Federal Reserve. And so we've got a stronger dollar despite the lower oil prices today. That is new. Looking over at the bond market, we've got yields made a big move yesterday. Not such a big move today. But noteworthy, the two-year yield at one point jumped up like 14 basis points during Kevin Warsh's, or the aftermath of Kevin Warsh's or Kurt Hook's press conference yesterday. But right now, a more muted move here. We've got the 30-year yield is actually down almost 6 basis points here, 4.869%. The 10-year yield is down 2 points at 4.437. Meanwhile, the 2-year is up again, another 2.5 points at 4.189, and the 1 month is at 3.648, up by a half a point. Let's look at CME Fed Watch Tool here. This is telling us what they think interest rates are going to be at the end of the year based on interest rate futures. And we looked at this yesterday. Yesterday, it was about 60-40, that 60% chance we get some form of a rate hike by the end of the year. Now, today, it is 77-13. The odds of rate hikes have gone up substantially. There's only a 13% chance that the Fed leaves rates where they're currently at between now and December. All right, rate cuts no longer even appear on this chart. There's a 36% chance we get one hike, a 35% chance we get two hikes, a 14% chance we get three hikes, and even a 2% chance of four rate hikes. Warsh made it abundantly clear yesterday, the next move at the Fed will be a tightening. Looking over at Bitcoin, Bitcoin doesn't like higher rates, but it is a little bit lower again this morning, $64,345 as priced on Coinbase. It's fallen about 3 days in a row after having a good week last week. One thing to note on Bitcoin, let's take a look at Stretch. That is the MicroStrategy preferred shares. This is Michael Saylor's infinite money glitch. It's supposed to be pegged to $100 because if this price goes above $100, they'll issue shares and use the proceeds to buy Bitcoin. If the price goes below $100, they'll automatically raise the dividend and bring the value right back up, right? Well, no, not so much, because it has now been trading below par, the $100 value that they advertised, for almost a month and a half here, or more than a month. This thing is never supposed to dip below 100 for more than a few days, and it's been there for over a month now, trading just $89.50. So if you bought this thing expecting your 11% yield, you've already lost a year's worth of yield, a year's worth of dividend, just with the price falling. This is a silly product. It was deceptively marketed to low information investors. They made it sound like it was a money market, when in reality, this is really just a debt instrument with an unsustainable yield where the borrower never has to pay you back. And I think Strategy has opened itself up to a huge legal liability with the way they marketed this product. And I think it's only a matter of time before the class action lawsuits start flying. And if that gets expensive and they have to pay out a big settlement, where is they going to get the money? Well, by selling Bitcoin. And that is how a infinite money glitch turns into a doom loop. Meanwhile, we've got commodities are red pretty much across the board this morning. Spot gold is down by $4, $4,253, or 0.09% lower. Gold and silver both took a tumble yesterday on Warsh's comments about higher rates. Stronger dollar, higher interest rates, not good for gold or silver. That is why precious metals not doing so good here. Spot silver, $66.75, down $1.16 after falling 3% yesterday, or about $3 yesterday, currently down 1.7%. I still like the shiny long-term, but rate hikes are not good for precious metals. See also that gold and silver chart in 2021 and 2022. Looking over at copper, we're lower by 0.9%. Platinum lower by 3.8%. Palladium lower by 4%. Crude oil down another 3% here. $74.43 for WTI crude, down by another $2.35. And that is predominantly being driven by this Iran news. So let's talk about it. We got this one in Bloomberg. The first Saudi supertankers start leaving Hormuz after the deal. Three Saudi supertankers were among a growing list of vessels exiting the Strait of Hormuz in an early sign of rising flows after the U.S. and Iran's interim peace deal, although some trade groups warned that their members needed more clarity on mines and other practicalities. The ships controlled by Saudi Arabia's Bahri are carrying about 6 million barrels of Saudi oil and mark the first Saudi-owned crude tankers to cross the strait since the war began. The three ships switched on their signals in the Gulf of Oman on Thursday, having been stuck inside the Persian Gulf since the start of the conflict. There were other signs of movement, although visible traffic still remains extremely light compared to pre-war levels. A fourth supertanker carrying oil from the UAE, a ship carrying Qatari LNG, and a Chinese fuel tanker were seen crossing the strait with their signals on, while a second LNG tanker appeared off Qatar after last signaling outside the strait. So we've got the boats are starting to flow here. However, some parts of the shipping and oil industries remain cautious on Thursday, warning that it's still not clear how traffic would be managed and when or how any mines in the strait would be cleared. While both sides have said that the waterway would be fully open without tolls for the 60 days covered in the memorandum of understanding between the U.S. and Iran, Tehran has repeatedly indicated its intention to retain some level of management over the strait. The MOU, while welcome, doesn't offer ship owners and their insurers the full assurance needed to restore traffic through Hormuz, according to Lloyd's Market Association, which represents managing agents at Lloyd's of London. So look, okay, 60 days, no tolls. What happens when after 60 days, an American tanker or an Indian tanker or whoever, a Saudi tanker is transiting the strait and they refuse to pay the $2 million toll to the Iranians and the Iranians put a drone in her hull? What happens then? This conflict starts all over again. And this deal is so bad that I think this just guarantees that this conflict flares up again at some point within the next 2 months. I'd love to be wrong about that, but it really looks like that's what's going to happen here. And even as some of these tankers are flowing now, we've got other countries are having trouble finding tankers willing to go in again because they don't really have any assurance that the conflict is over. PetroChina and Indian Oil failed to secure tankers to load Iraqi crude, sources say. This one just this morning in Reuters. PetroChina and Indian Oil Corp failed to secure very large crude carriers to lift Iraqi Basra crude in late June, company and shipping sources said on Thursday, while another Chinese major, Sinochem, is on the hunt for a tanker. The inquiries from the Chinese state energy firms this week follow an interim deal between the U.S. and Iran to end the war and reopen the Strait of Hormuz. The Chinese major received at least six offers at world scale points of $650 to $750, they said, representing rates nearly triple those charged before the U.S. and Israel launched the war in late February. The world scale measure is used by the shipping industry to calculate freight rates. There are tankers available, but the problem is it's too expensive and there is no guarantee you can exit the strait, a PetroChina official said. And that statement right there is telling. Yes, things are improving. Some oil is flowing, but the tankers are still charging a lot of money because the captains are reluctant to go inside the strait because they're not sure they can get out. Why? Because there's no clarity about mines, about toll booths, about drones hitting them. And this conflict could just flare up again like it's done every other time we've signed a ceasefire or been inches away from peace. So, you know, there's some encouraging signs, some oil starting to flow, but still a lot of caution and a lot of questions out there. Meanwhile, we've got Intel shares soar after Trump says it struck an Apple chip deal. We don't know if this deal actually happened, just that Trump said a thing and now the stock is ripping. Intel stock surged more than 9% in pre-market trading Thursday after U.S. President Donald Trump said the chip maker will work alongside Apple to design and produce semiconductors domestically. Does Apple know this? Does Intel know this? I don't know. But Trump didn't elaborate on that tie-up, which he mentioned after championing NVIDIA and Elon Musk's Terafab chip-making ambitions in a Truth Social post. The iPhone maker has held exploratory discussions about using Intel and Samsung to produce the main processors for its devices in the U.S. I decided to help Intel because we need to design and build our chips right here in America, Trump posted. Apple has agreed to work with Intel to design and build its chips in America. But spokespeople for Intel and Apple didn't immediately respond to requests for a comment. Look, Intel, I've heard a lot about this chip fab that's going to be built in the United States, but all I ever see are headlines about how they're delayed, even though the government gave them a whole bunch of money, bought all this stock in the company. They were supposed to get that factory up and running. Here we are a year later. I don't know that we're really any closer to that, but Intel stock is ripping on this news. Let's refresh and get a quote here. Up 8.2% pre-market. Trading at $131.11, up 10 bucks. Year to date, Intel up 228% since the government announced they were taking a stake in the company. Up 228%. But what did we get for our money? Where is the freaking factory? Okay, we got a Truth Social post where President Trump says a thing about Apple and Intel, and Apple and Intel are unavailable for comment. So is it true? I don't know. Yeah, start building the chips already because Taiwan's getting closer, guys. Meanwhile, we got more Apple news here, more inflation. Apple to raise prices due to memory chip crunch, Tim Cook says. The CEO tells the Journal in an exclusive interview that soaring costs make price increases unavoidable. So we all get to pay more for Apple products so Sam and Dario's shitty chatbots can keep burning tokens. Apple plans to raise prices on its product to offset the surging costs of memory and storage chips, CEO Tim Cook said in an exclusive interview with the Wall Street Journal. Unfortunately, price increases are unavoidable. We're doing our best to mitigate the huge increases that are being passed to us, and we've been trying to shield our customers from the increases, but the situation has become unsustainable. Cook declined to offer details on the timing or the scale of the planned price increases, nor which products would be affected. Apple's next major product launch is likely to be in September when it releases the iPhone 18 lineup, expected to include a new foldable iPhone. Price increases, especially for Macs and iPads, could come sooner. Apple raised the starting price of the Mac Mini last month in between launch events. Skyrocketing demand for memory and storage chips from artificial intelligence companies has pushed up their costs so much that Apple would have to raise device prices substantially to maintain its profit margins. Passing the higher cost on to consumers while maintaining its profit margin would add about $270 to the price of the next iPhone Pro model, estimates research firm Tech Insights. $270 more on the next iPhone being driven by this AI build-out inflation. And that is what Kevin Warsh was referring to when he said, you can see the demand signals from AI. You can see the inflation it is causing. But where are the freaking productivity gains? You can't see them because they're not there. They don't exist. Yes, I know. I know software developers. I know you use it. Thank you very much. That's nice. We'll see you guys next week. But that being said, here you can see it. Prices are going up because of the AI build-out. So yeah, we've had this big jump in inflation, and it is largely due to oil and what's happened in Iran. But AI is also causing a lot of this inflation. How much? I guess we'll see. Now that oil is beginning to normalize, we should come back down to a level in the next 2 or 3 months, maybe 4 to 5. I don't know how long it's going to take. But eventually, we should settle at a level where it'll be easier for us to see how much of this inflation is due to AI. And again, with no commensurate productivity gains, it means this is just capital being wasted. If only somebody had been warning us about that for the last 3.5 years. But Apple stock is actually up 0.5%. It fell about 1.1% yesterday, up about 0.5% this morning. Again, you got two Apple stories. You got the Trump Intel thing going on, and then you got the price hikes from yesterday, $297.32 a share for Apple stock, which is up about 8.8%, almost 9% year to date. All right, taxpayer bag holders, the question for you guys, paper or plastic? Because Trump advisors weigh structure of AI stakes. And there's Mr. Lutnick and Mr. Bessent, who have differing ideas about how your tax dollars and your inflation could be used to finance the AI bubble. Senior Trump administration officials have weighed how to structure potential government equity stakes in major AI companies before the government's export controls on Anthropic further roiled the industry. Two top cabinet members had discussed different ideas. People familiar with the talks told Semaphore. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent favored using equity in AI firms to seed Trump accounts, while Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick's preference was that any equity be directed to a type of sovereign wealth fund. The talks about the possible AI stakes ceded to the government are still in the early stages with no decisions made yet, and a meeting with industry CEOs that President Trump previewed earlier this month is yet to emerge. Given that, it's still unclear where the Trump administration could ultimately land on an idea that remains an extremely tough sell for most of the industry beyond OpenAI, which first pitched it last year. Executives at firms like Microsoft and Meta have turned a cold shoulder in the last week alone. The administration's crackdown on the latest models from Anthropic may also complicate equity talks. Trump told reporters last week that he would convene the top 12 or 15 executives very shortly to discuss the AI industry giving back something to the public. But Friday's export controls risk turning any meeting into a more tense affair. First of all, let's talk about this bullshit right here, giving back something to the public. No, that is not what they're talking about. They are talking about the public giving money to Sam Altman and Dario Amodei, the multi-billionaires, to pump their bags at our expense. They are giving nothing to the public. They are taking from you in the form of taxes and higher inflation to pump the AI bubble, which has done nothing for your quality of life, just driven up your cost of living while bombarding you with slop and crap that you can't even tell if it's true or not. But let's talk about the two options here. Treasury Secretary Bessent wants to use equity in AI firms to seed Trump accounts. All right, this is the most honest thing I've seen from the administration in years, and I don't mean that in a good way, because we all knew Trump accounts was just nothing more than a stealth form of taxpayers pumping the stock market, right? Borrowing and printing money to give to kids. But why? To buy stocks, to inflate stock values. That's why. It was about keeping the stock market bubble inflated. And now here they are saying, well, since we've already created this big pump mechanism, let's just put the AI stocks right in that. Oh, congratulations, kid born yesterday. You've got shares in OpenAI, which loses money at a rate the world once thought impossible. A company that adds no value to anything while burning money on fire. We're all going to be rich. Now, the alternative here is what Howard Lutnick is talking about, where the sovereign wealth fund buys stakes in OpenAI and Anthropic. Okay, so that's great. So the federal government, which is telling them what products they're allowed to release already, buys a huge stake in the company. And then what? The government votes those shares. So the federal government is appointing board members now and firing CEOs who don't do what they want. There's a word for that. That's communism, y'all. That is absolutely communism. Government ownership of the means of production. And the other question, for that matter, if we do these Trump accounts, seeding them with AI shares, who votes those shares? Is it the custodian of the accounts, the kids' parents? The kids obviously aren't voting the shares. Or does the government retain voting rights on those shares? I've got more questions. But either way, guys, this is all about what form the taxpayer bag holders are going to take, paper or plastic. Meanwhile, the next crisis is in the making here, folks. Indonesia raises rates again to go all out supporting the rupiah. And there's only one sentence in this whole article that is telling the truth about what's really going on here. Sure, oil is playing a big role. Indonesia's central bank raised its key interest rate for a third time in about a month, extending its aggressive efforts to stabilize the rupiah and shore up investor confidence. Now, that's important, guys. We've seen a lot of articles about Fed left rates on change. European Central Bank raised rates, right? These are monthly, sometimes bi-monthly meetings that are happening at all these different central banks. Indonesia has hiked rates three times in the last month. They are panicking in Indonesia because the rupiah is losing value. Bank of Indonesia lifted the benchmark rate by 25 basis points to 5.75% on Thursday, in line with what the majority of analysts had surveyed. The latest move follows a surprise hike on June 9th, just 2 weeks ago, and a bigger than expected 50 basis point increase in May, bringing total tightening to 100 basis points this year. That's 100 basis points in the last 34, 33 days. They are aggressively hiking there. Governor Perry Warijo said in a briefing announcing the decision that the bank would continue to go all out to support the rupiah, using his go-to catchphrase when describing Bank Indonesia's support for the goals of President Prabowo Subianto. And it's that president's goals there that's the problem. Obviously, the rupiah is falling because of what happened with oil. We've seen that in the currencies of most of these Southeast Asian countries. But the Indonesian rupiah has been falling very substantially, and there's a reason for that. And they mention it down here. Plans for a new state-backed commodity export agency also risks disrupting the trade flows that help support the rupiah. We talked about this a lot in some of the prior weeks. Indonesia has been nationalizing all of their natural resources. See also communism, which apparently we're doing that here, so why not do it in Indonesia? But the government has been taking over all of their industries, all of their big resource exports. And exports is how Indonesia gets dollars, and they need those dollars to buy oil. And, well, the price of oil goes up, so they need more dollars. And if you're messing with your exports, maybe people are less inclined to do business with you, which could mean fewer dollars coming in, and people start dumping your currency because it becomes obvious your trade deficit is going to blow out, and you'll have to print in order to fix it. And so the reason why their central bank is so aggressively hiking is because their president is destroying their currency by nationalizing their industry. This is the Venezuelization of Indonesia. I've been warning about this. And this is the next big humanitarian crisis in the making. If they stay on this path, this entire country will be dumpster diving in the next 10 years. There's still time to stop it, but apparently the central bank is going all out, or they're all in on this stupid policy. So good luck, man. It's not going to be a good time to be in Indonesia in the next 10 years. Meanwhile, we talked a lot about inflation, guys, and we got more of that this morning. Canadian PPI, producer price inflation, measuring inflation further upstream, 13.6% for the month of May, up from 11.4% in April and 7.8% in March. Of course, guys, that is oil, maybe a little bit of tariffs also sprinkled on top there, but the writing is on the wall. There is higher consumer price inflation on the horizon, in Canada, in the U.S., and in Europe, even though we've got this deal in Iran now, maybe that limits some of the future damage. It's still going to get worse before it gets better. And last but not least, Oaktree Private Credit Fund redemptions drop below key 5% limit. And you know, this is a fund that was over the 5% limit not too long ago. I think it was like 8.5% last quarter. And most of the private credit funds that limited redemptions last quarter, the requests got bigger and they limited them again. This is an exception here. Oaktree, actually, the request went from like 8.5% down to 4.5%. So that's good for Oaktree. This is not a doomer article here. This is like, okay, there's some signs of light in the private credit industry. But this is one fund. And it's kind of telling that when a fund's redemption requests drop below 5% and they don't get gated, that becomes news. That in and of itself is profound to me. The fact that a fund not gating redemptions is now garnering headlines. It goes to show you how far and how fast the private credit industry has fallen. And despite this one silver lining, there is still a great big gray cloud of suck in the private credit industry, as every other firm has seen their request for redemptions increase further from already sky high levels last quarter. So, you know, it's another one of those things that if only somebody had been warning us about that for several years now, if only. Hey guys, I just want to say thank you for having your coffee with the Melonheads this morning. Don't forget the like button and the subscribe button on the way out, should you feel so inclined. Thank you very much to my magnanimous Melonheads on Patreon, YouTube, and Buy Me a Coffee for supporting the channel. Links down there in the description. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Love you guys. Everybody, till next time, live small and dream big.